Undoubtedly, I'm an addict. Hello, everybody. I waited for this for a long time. I was given a medal on the 5th of August this year. And I've been clean for VIII years. That's a lot of years. I've been an addict all my life. And I've split it down to four distinct addictions. The first addiction I ever had got into was lust without love. Sex without love. Sex with myself. Sex in isolation. That was my number one habit. And it was a killer. My second habit was alcohol. And that was a killer. My third habit was television. And that's a killer. And I know because I work in it. And my fourth habit was drugs. And I believe that the program of Narcotics Anonymous is right for all of those habits. I come from a family that was disrupted by my mother's alcoholism, my father's workaholism, the war in England. I'm 54 years old. I was 6 years old when the war started, but in our household it had started in 1937 instead of 1939. So by the time the Germans came along, it was almost quite a nice little relief. At least my mother and father shut up during the air raids. Made a change. And I don't think there was anything the Germans came up with that could match what my mother could come up with and my father could come up with when they really got going, throwing the dishes at each other and whacking the kids. I found many, many years in recovery that I had a great deal of compassion for my promiscuous and alcoholic mother. And I had no compassion at all for my workaholic father, who picked up on the responsibility of bringing up his children when my mother ran off. I found it very, very difficult to find compassion and to find love and to find understanding in my heart, which seemed very cruel. My first addiction, my lonely self-sex, I describe these because the impulse, the initial impulse was the same. It started off with a secret. It started off with a secret going around my older brother and his friends. My older brother was a bit like a large truck, like a garbage truck in the narrow lane, and I was behind it in what I thought was a mean little Porsche, trying to honk and hoot and rev the engine and get round him. And I could never get round him. And he used to come up with these secrets, these little knowing things, he and his friends being a bit older than me. And I always had to get in on it. I could never stand being left out. I hated anybody having something cooking that I wasn't in on. And eventually I got one of his, the fringes of his friends to tell me what the hell had been going on. And what they've been going on, they've been shaking one part of their anatomy and changing their mood and giving themselves an amazing high followed by a lot of depression. And I got off on that. But I got off on it alone. They used to do it standing around together. See who could come first. He was the winner. That's how much we knew about sex. The guy that came quickest was the winner. That was an attitude that had to change. You know, me, I was into it alone. I was into my own bag. I was into it alone. I've got a secret, and I've got something to change my mood. My second habit, booze, became very attractive to me because when our family had broken up, we used to go and stay in a hotel for Christmas with our dad. And the one thing that put a look and an expression of approval on our dad's face was alcoholic behavior in other people, especially guys that would smash up their cars or do something crazy in the dance hall, fall over the table, crash out, fall off the stool at the bar. My dad would get that look on his face and he'd say, "Mad devil." And he'd smile. And I thought, that's it. That's how I'm going to please my dad. But it didn't work with me. I got beaten up. He gave me a bad time. But I took to that booze, and I loved it, and I wanted to be an alcoholic. I was attracted by them right from the very word go. I wanted to be an alcoholic. Many, many years later, my father called me a failure throughout most of my adult life. And one day I turned around to him and I said, "But Dad, I'm an alcoholic, and I always wanted to be an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict, and I always wanted to be a drug addict." And he said, "You're not an alcoholic at all. You're not an addict at all. You're just a bloody fool." My dad would sooner that I was stupid than sick and getting well. The greatest and most important thing I ever did in my life, which is coming into Narcotics Anonymous and getting well, to him, is nothing. So that's his problem now, not mine. The day that I found booze worked for me was exactly the same as the day I found shaking my, what do you call it? My dick. In England we call it willy, but I'm here to translate and to help you guys to understand. It's the same in any language. But it was the same feeling. And when I was a student in London, I used to work in a rock and roll club all night and then turn up at the academy the next morning, crashing out, falling asleep. And one of the girls that I was going out with said, "Listen, we've got these lovely little pills. There's the pink ones and the blue ones and the yellow ones. And if you drop one of the pink ones or two of the blue ones or three of the yellow ones, shazam, you can have a good time." And that same initial feeling hit me again. I'd found something that would turn it on, that would work it, that I could control, I thought, that changed the way I feel. And it was, again, it was secret. And that had a lot to do with it for me. I could do it alone. And I moved into a room, and this was when TV was brand new. And the landlady said, "There's a special treat." She said, "Look, in your corner of your room," and she turned on this box, and in this box came on a light and these pictures came on, and I had the same feeling, the same response. This I can do alone. I don't need anybody else. This will change the way I feel. This is a mood changer, and I can get hooked into it, and I can stay in it. It's the same thing. I married an American alcoholic in 1962. I reckon she was about 3 years further down the toilet than I was. And I was a willing pupil. I learned fast. And it was a very, very rough ride indeed. I didn't know how naive I was. But I wanted what she had. And I got it. And we had a son. And one day, I was in a show, and I couldn't learn the words in the show. And it was a very important show for me at home. And I couldn't learn it. And I resented everybody else connected with the show. I resented the writer, I resented the director, the other actors, I resented the designer. I resented everybody. So I took a load of Tylenol tablets. And instead of opening in the show, I opened the next day in hospital. I couldn't face it. And what came to horrify me in recovery about that was that not once during the whole of that process did I even remember that I had a son. There was a measure of the selfishness that I was into. It never occurred to me that through this selfish act I was robbing a son of his father. So I didn't think about that until 13 years later in recovery. Everything I did in public at this time. Everything damaging I did in public. I was given every opportunity in my career in England. I was given it on a plate. And every time I was handed it, I turned around and I kicked the people that handed it to me. I carried resentments brilliantly. I was the man that could stand in a crowded room full of shouting people and make one cutting remark that would cut like a snake right the way across the action and hit home. I scored a lot of deadly points like a laser. I told so many people to fuck off that they did, eventually, and I was out in the cold. I joined the other fellowship. Guess which one? And they were very kind to me for 13 years. I carried on using for 13 years in the other fellowship. I became the secretary of a meeting for 2 years, and it became a very small meeting. And nobody ever said anything. And on my 13th year of what I used to call my recovery, God decided he'd had enough. And he picked me up and he dropped me into an American movie for Universal Studios being shot in the West Indies, home of various substances of a mind-altering nature, with accompanying music. And I arrived in this paradise of a place called Antigua. And even I could not bring my then common law wife and 2 babies to this paradise. So I rented a little house and I called them up and I said, bring the babies. I said, and bring the next door neighbor and their babies as well. So that I could sit out on the stoop and get stones, and if there was any hassle with the kids, I'd say, look, there's 2 of you bitches. Can't you handle it? And everybody was saying, what a generous guy this Dudley is, bringing this, the next door neighbor and their kids, hundreds of miles to the Caribbean. What a generous man, how kind. And I basked in that. There's nothing to do with that at all. I had my own life and I didn't want anything to interfere with it. My television, I used to sit and watch these really boring political documentaries, so that I could say, please don't bother me with children that are dying. I'm looking after the world. Please. And this is crap. After 13 years of sickness in the other fellowship, there I was in Antigua with more drugs than I'd ever had in my life. Going to one meeting of the other fellowship a week to keep it respectable. Telling everybody in the movie what I was doing, just in case they didn't know. So they'd think that I was a nice, healthy man. I wasn't. As long as I wasn't drunk in public, as long as I wasn't drunk in and around my business, I thought I was okay. The fact that I was turning up on the set on tripping on acid, I'm telling you, I did a cowboy film in Madrid years ago, and the director came up and he said, and I was sitting on this stagecoach playing a deaf mute, thank God, because I didn't have to remember anything. And I'm sitting there, and it's the hot sun, and I'm tripping. And the director said, right, Dudley, he said, when I say action, I want you to take your double-barrel shotgun and fire one shot between the two horses' heads towards the door. And as you swing round, fire another shot towards the church, swing round, put the rifle in the holster, climb down, pull out your two guns, give it two as you run across towards the church, two more to the other corner, two more to that corner of the square, and two more towards the camera. You go into the church door, you shut the door, you run up to the first floor. On the first floor window, there are five pistols. I want you to pick them up, and I want you to fire one down there, and one over there, and one over there, and one over there, and one in the center. Did you get that? And in my trip, I said to myself, hook on to this guy. Just hook on a couple of grappling irons. So I said, not quite. Would you say it again? He told me the whole thing again. They said, action, and I went, tung, 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 zoom, 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 up the church, bong, 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 bong. Cut it, print it, it was fine. But I don't remember it. Luckily, nobody remembers the movie. It was a stinker. But here I was in the West Indies, having the worst time I've ever had in my life, because underneath all my good-natured exterior, underneath all my supposed kindness, was a deep, trembling rage, which expressed itself in little bursts of anger, little bursts of irritation. I was very good at breaking the spirit of whatever old lady I was with by tooting and sighing, by dragging around like a weight. I would break her spirit. I liked my women, and God bless the women here, forgive me for it, but I liked my women to look as if they'd been up since 5 a.m. scrubbing the steps by the time I got up. I liked them to look whipped. I hated women. When I came into recovery, I was full of fear, and I was giving this woman a very, very bad time. And God decided, as I said, he'd had enough, and so he'd made something go wrong with the movie, and I had to go to Miami. And I went to Miami, and everybody else went home, and I kept up my regular one meeting of the other fellowship, and I went to a place in Miami, I think it was called the Little River Club. And I heard people say, for the first time in my life, I don't know whether they'd said it around me before, but it was the first time I ever heard, my name is George, I'm an addict and an alcoholic. My name is Harry, I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My name is Jennifer, I'm an alcoholic addict, blah, blah, blah. And I knew the game was up. And I was glad the game was up. I was very frightened. I was living in the Holiday Inn in Miami, and I was practicing three of my four habits. I had an all-night TV. I had been working my dick so hard that it was torn. This was what I used to call love. It was torn quite badly, and it took an enormous dexterity, a real addict dexterity, to bring it to fruition without ripping it too much more, because you don't feel the pain until you come. And I had to keep coming. I was an orgasm addict. There's a punk song in England called Orgasm Addict that really hit me hard. I thought, how dare they sing such filthy stuff on the radio? You know? Disgusting. So there I was, bleeding, stoned, with a lot of very, very bad drugs, in this hotel room. And I went to this Little River Club, and I heard it. and I shut up like a clam. When I put on my gracious performance, how very kind of you, thank you very much. Oh, you're going to take me for a hamburger now, how very hospitable you Americans are. You know, off there, be driven off to have a hamburger, and then driven back to my hotel. And at about 4 o'clock in the morning, I went down on my knees in despair, because I realized that I was in Miami, thousands of miles away from home, in a very exotic and beautiful part of the world, into my three surviving habits, and as sick as I've ever been in my life, and I'd had enough. And I went down on my knees and I prayed for help. And downstairs in the pool bar, and I don't remember what time this was, but there was an actor on the movie trying to get, as we say in England, get his leg over the girl that worked behind the bar. He was trying to get his leg over. And she wasn't having it. And he thought if I ply her with a bit of gin, maybe the things will improve. So he kept inviting her to have a drink. And she said no. And eventually she said, look, I don't drink. I'm a member of another fellowship. Yeah. So he said, oh, there's a guy in room 246, whatever it was, who'd like that. And that's how I got to be at the River Club, the Little River Club. That's how I heard what I needed to hear for the first time. But it took me two more days, two more nights. The next night, a fellow rang up and he said, hi, Dudley, I met you at the meeting. Are you coming to a meeting the next day? A couple coming to a meeting tonight? And I had this big voice and this little voice, this tiny little voice, a bit like the transatlantic phone, you know, when you keep missing. Like two giant condoms, you know, you're talking to these two condoms that aren't quite getting in touch with you. There's a sort of missing all the time and an echo. And my big voice said, I'm very sorry, I'm afraid I can't come to a meeting tonight. I'm working. And my tiny little voice said, I've got a drug problem. And he didn't hear that. I heard it. And the next night, I was back at it again, manipulating to prevent myself splitting up too much, watching this all-night TV, going up on one load of drugs, coming down on the other, round and round the circles, and in despair, and crying. And the next time the phone rang, it was the girl from the pool, and she said, Dudley, we're going to a meeting this evening. Do you want to come? And I heard this big voice say, I can't. I've got a drug problem. And she laughed, too. She laughed. And she said, that's terrific. She said, can you get through the lobby? And I thought that was the most brilliant thing I'd ever heard in my life, because nobody but another addict would think, can you get through the lobby? You can stay in your room forever, you can be in the anonymity of the street, but you can't get through that fucking lobby because there's the English guy on the desk that knows that you use. And I recognized the true voice of an addict. And that girl saying, can you get through the lobby? I knew I was home. And I said, I can get through anywhere. She said, fine, there'll be a van to meet you outside the hotel this evening at 7:30, be there. I said, right, I put the phone down. I got all the drugs in the little plastic bags and the big plastic bags, and I flushed them down the john. I didn't even think about it, which was a shame because I blocked the john and I've got diarrhea. Little paranoia moved in. We're in Miami Beach. The plumber is going to be a black man. Black men know about drugs. He's going to pull that plastic bag out of the john and he's going to see what it is. I'm very naive. And when I get back to the hotel for my walk, the drug squad are going to be there. And my movie career will be finished. That's what I thought. And I thought, I don't care. I don't care. I washed and I scrubbed myself. I cleaned myself like I never cleaned myself before. I changed every stitch of clothing. I put on my sunglasses and I went out for a walk. I went a long walk around the block. And on my way out, I went to the guy on the counter in the lobby, and I said, I've blocked my John. That's perfectly all right, sir. Well, and when I came back, there was no drug squad there. The place had been cleaned up. That evening, a van arrived, one of those lovely vans with fisheye windows and lots of young people in. I was 47, and I'm still a teenager. I still identify. I always go in the door marked young people, you know. Pick out a little pair of jeans, you know, 22 waist. This fit me, you know. Little tank top. I'm still like that. Did it this morning. And this van was there, and all these kids were in it, and the FM station was playing. I got into the front seat, beautiful air, like an airline seat. And we drove off, and they said, you know where we're going? And I said, no. And I said, they said, we're going to Narcotics Anonymous. And I went, Narcotics Anonymous? Moi? I said, but I'm not a... And they all looked at me and laughed, and they said, what have you been using? And I told them, and they laughed. Bastards. What about my pain? They laughed. And they said, how long have you been using? And for the first time, I checked it up. 13 years. They said, 13 years constitutes a habit. And I don't think I have ever been so proud in my life as when I was told that I qualify for membership of Narcotics Anonymous. And I mean that. I still feel that pride tonight. That pride has never lessened. I believe that the day I walked into Narcotics Anonymous, that I had the blessed hand of God on my shoulder. And I don't think that that hand has ever been lifted since. I was taken to a clubhouse that existed then on Biscayne Boulevard. And I was taken into the arms of this fellowship. And I was enveloped in it, and I was hugged. I was hugged until I was blue. And I heard things in that first 10 minutes. To live with me today, I heard love not lust, hugs not drugs. People said to me, be careful what you pray for, you're liable to get it. If you pray for a rhinoceros, make sure your yard is big enough to contain a rhinoceros, because a rhinoceros is what you're liable to be delivered of. And I prayed for quite a few rhinoceroses in my time, and that's what I've got. They gave me a white poker chip. They said, this is to show that you've been gambling with your life. And the next day when I went to buy a newspaper, I took out my money and there was the white poker chip, and I burst into tears on the street. And the guy selling the newspaper looked at me a bit funny, and I didn't give a damn. I love it. Dear Dudley, the band is a little late. Please talk a little longer. You betcha. I couldn't believe Narcotics Anonymous. I couldn't believe that all the people that I've always wanted to know and always wanted to be friendly with were now my friends. The first thing that happened in early recovery was that I recognized that little figure that had been dancing in front of my nose for so many years as I tried to drink my way towards it. Masturbate my way towards it, teleview my way towards it, drug my way towards this character, was me clean. This kind of nice, happy person was me clean. Not me successful, not me famous, not me rich, but me clean. People sometimes say, when you're talking to newcomers, go easy on the God bit. Well, I don't go heavy on the God bit, but I'm damned if I'm ever going to deny a newcomer any aspect of this recovery program. Because I have never yet met an addict coming into recovery that hadn't had inside herself or himself a deep spiritual yearning. And I know that I had a deep spiritual yearning all of my life. And I didn't understand it until I came into NA. And now I understand it. I was only in Miami for a week. I love to think that I'm awkward enough to choose the drug capital of America to get clean in. Yeah? And at the end of the week, I had to go home. And I said, what am I going to do? They said, well, you go around the other fellowship, and you call yourself an alcoholic and an addict and see what happens. I said, I can't do that. I said, I've been around that fellowship for 13 years in England. I said, if I go back there, they'll say, he's just another bloody actor trying to upstage everybody, trying to be dramatic. They said, look, just go home and call yourself an alcoholic and an addict and see what happens. I said, well, they'll throw me, just see what happens. So I went home to England, and I went to my old meeting that I used to be the secretary of, and it had got huge. There'd been a palace revolution in my absence, and the place had gotten busy. Those people were getting off their habit and doing very well. Anyway, I sat there, and I was very scared, and I said, I'm Dudley, I'm a alcoholic and an addict, and I'm very glad to be here. And they afterwards, they said, is that what it was? We never knew. We didn't understand. You've been around for 13 years. You've even helped people recover. We've seen you help people. Done a lot of help in that fellowship, and people have got well around you, and you never got well yourself, and we didn't understand it. This is wonderful. Tell us about it. And I told them about it, and they were very, very interested, and they allowed me to qualify in that way, and I went on doing it for a year. And after a few weeks of it, a bloke came up to me, a bloke whose name became synonymous in America with NA in England, Johnny. A lot of you know Johnny. Johnny asked me to send his love to you tonight. He's got a lot of friends in America. He couldn't be here. But he came up to me and said, what's all this about then? And I told him. And he said, oh, he said, that's me. He said, there's another one over there called Janet. Come and meet Janet. So I went over to meet Janet. And I began to meet a few people. There were only about seven of us. And one day, an Irishman came up to us in a cafe that now all the fellowships in England use. And he said, I'm sick to death of hearing you talking about... he's Irish, so I can do all the accents. I'm sick to death of hearing you talking about drugs in these meetings, he says. And I thought, hello, here it comes, what I've always been waiting to happen. And he pulled out a file and he threw it on the table. He said, here's a starter pack for Narcotics Anonymous from Frankfurt in Germany. There's a room available on Thursday nights at 7:30. The rent is £2 a week, negotiable. Let's hear no more of it. So... we seven people were put in the most extraordinary position, and I believe one of the most privileged positions that can happen to an addict. We were put into a position of starting the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous in another country. And I was scared stiff, and I know the others were scared stiff. And it was about 4 o'clock in the morning that I suddenly woke up and I realized that this had happened exactly 1 year to the week that I'd become a member of Narcotics Anonymous in Miami, August the 5th, 1979. And NA started in London around August the 5th, 1980. It took a long time. A lot of the members of the other fellowship came to look at the freaks. And then they got bored and went back about their own business. We've always had the best looking girls. And some of them came to check that out too, and a fat lot of good it did them. The first time I saw Narcotics Anonymous literature, it made me cry. The first time I saw me described in black and white, it made me cry. The first time I saw those darling words, "We are not interested in what you used or how much or who your connections were," I was so filled with joy and with love that I cried, and I only cry through happiness these days. Because if we're not interested in what we used or how much or who our connections were, there's going to be no more fucking upstaging. And thank God for that, because the words that we used on the street for our own elitism were very, very damaging in NA in the beginning in London. For me to identify myself by the drugs that I used is old, sick street behavior, and I don't do it. I don't like it. I have been upstaged or had to upstage other people all of my life. And here, I don't want to be any better or any worse than you guys. I think that one of the extraordinary experiences we had in London was that, in a way, the fellowship seems to behave like an addict. The fellowship grows in a way that an addict does. Our fellowship relapsed. It did. When we were very, very new, when we were very new in England, we had nobody coming in off the streets. Only Johnny and Janet and myself and a couple of others came in off the streets. The rest of them came from very high class backgrounds, from very expensive treatment centers. And God bless them that they came, because without them we wouldn't have had a fellowship. But I didn't understand what the hell they were talking about, because they had this treatment center language, which isn't NA language. I love NA language, because NA language was invented by us. It talks about me, because you people and me, our people, made it. Nobody can con the fellowship. We can only con ourselves. In the way that those words, "Can you get through the lobby," struck home to me, so the language of the literature of NA strikes home to me. Because I know it's true, because I've been there. And I know when people talk to me in the fellowship that they're not jiving me, because I know, because I can hear it. And I love it. There is not a corner of my life that hasn't been changed by this fellowship. I got back home to England, and the first thing I had to do was to deal with the fact that only 2 weeks clean, I couldn't stand the sight of my old lady. And then I had to admit that I hadn't liked her since the first month that I was with her. And that the first time I ever saw her pregnant with our first child, I realized and I knew that I didn't like her, and I hadn't got the nerve to tell her, because if the center of the universe doesn't like you, what are you going to do? And I was the center of the universe. And that was one of the worst things I've ever done, I think, to a woman. We had another child later. And I have always charged through relationships, greedy, selfish, bullying, and blind. And I came into Narcotics Anonymous with no feelings. And I got back to England, and somebody in NA had told me in America, pray for feelings. And I prayed for feelings, and God looked down into his little basket, and he picked out a feeling, and he dropped it down in a big arrow right down to the middle of my skull on the cliffs in Cornwall in England, and it was called jealousy. I got back home to England, and my old lady had decided she didn't like me either. And the bitch had found somebody else. And I knew it, because you've got a different hairstyle and a different sweater on. And she was smiling. She didn't look whipped anymore. And that really filled me with hate. And it filled me with fear. And the first great thing I had to learn in Narcotics Anonymous was this business of loving and not lusting. And I was told, you are going to have to love her whether you like it or not. You're going to have to pray that she gets what she wants for her and not what you want for her. And that's what I had to do. And I had to work hard at it, because I come from a broken family. My first son of the previous marriage had gone when he was 4 years old, and I had these two little children, and I didn't want to see them damaged. I know what damaged children look like. And the first time in my life I worked really, really hard at a relationship, and I had to work at its being broken up with kindness and with care. And I went down on my knees and I prayed again and again and again for what she wanted for her. And I looked at the man that she'd fallen in love with, and I was able to be shown that that man was not the devil, but that man was a very gentle and kind and caring man. And I saw that she'd fallen in love with a decent and caring man that was going to care for her, a man who also loved my children, and that's very rare. And I began to admire him. We split up, we went our ways. We went as gently as we could. She went just a little way down the road at first with the kids. And a year later, I was the guest of honor at her wedding. And I sat there with one of our children on each knee. She walked down the aisle, down in the registry office, and she was married. And I didn't have time. I had to go away, and I didn't go to the reception. But I'd been an honored guest at that wedding, and I got into the car, and I drove away up the freeway into the sunlight. And I'll never forget it, because I began to sing. And I'm still a little insane. When I'm really very, very happy, I sing, I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen, in a very old-fashioned kind of mock tenor voice. And I knew I was happy because I was singing up the motorway, I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen. And I suddenly realized that the reason I was happy was because for the first time in my life, I was a man. I'd never been a man before. I'd never loved before. I'd never had to love before. And I began to know what a man was. I thought a man was somebody that kicked his way through life and beat his way through life and fucked people, whether they wanted to be fucked or not. And God has shown me in the fellowship that a man is somebody who cares and loves. I didn't know what love was. And the fellowship picked me up by the scruff of the neck and showed me. The first time I put my hand around a shivering, sweating, shaking newcomer, I was terrified, but I did it. Our sponsor said, don't talk to people that you know when you go into meetings. This isn't a social night out. Find the person in the corner. I found that very, very hard, but I did do it. Talk to people, I started cleaning up with a broom. Nobody ever talks to the guy that's sweeping up. If you're scared of talking, get behind the broom. And it works. And I began to get less scared. Began to do service. Began to get involved. Then I got frightened again. In England now we've got
Well, in London, at any rate, we've got, I think, somebody will correct me, but it's about 75, 76 meetings a week of NA. I have been shown myself in Narcotics Anonymous. It long ago ceased to mean very much to do with drugs. I have been shown myself, and I'm beginning to like myself. My addictions are all leaving, even the television. I think that was one of the toughest. How are we doing for time? I came to this convention very privileged, and I'd like to thank you all for paying for my fare and my hotel. It's very kind of you. I deserve it. And you guys deserve the privilege. I love NA. I love recovering addicts. When I came in, I didn't love anybody. The hardest person that I've had to learn to love is myself. I still find it difficult, and I'm working on it. I don't want to go on anymore, because it'll just get padding. And I don't think there's anybody in this room that doesn't recognize padding when she or he hears it. So I'd like to say thank you very much, and God bless all of you. Thank you.